Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. Live from Hugh O'Connor's Irish Bar and Restaurant, here's Glenn Davis.
It's Hugh O'Connor's Pub, 7620 Katy Freeway, and our good friend Andrew Kapalski of the Snowdrop Foundation is in the house here. Andrew, thank you for being here. Reminder about Snowdrop Foundation, 501c charity. Probably know that I'm very involved with pediatric cancer awareness and fundraising. This is what the Snowdrop Foundation does. This is what Andrew does. So it's all about cancer awareness. We do dinners. Andrew does these wonderful, very intimate dinners with broadcasters and athletes and ex-boxers. We also do a big soccer dinner, which we need to, we need U of H, Rice, and A&M down there. Tom Clare does these dinners. We've had Norman Whiteside come in and speak. We've had Brian McClare, a lot of legendary Manchester United players. So we'll hope to get you guys down there this year. But it's all for pediatric cancer awareness and fundraising. It's snowdropfoundation.org. It's a 501c charity. And the main thing they do, though, is provide scholarships for kids that have had pediatric cancer, are being treated, or are cancer survivors. So that's the other beautiful thing it does. And if you remember, Trish and Kevin Klein spearheaded it. Gene's spearheading it now. But guys like Andrew Kapalski do a lot of the heavy lifting, and nobody really knows that. So they do now, Andrew. You're screwed. I'm just kidding you. You're in trouble now. All right, so that's snowdropfoundation.org, and a big thank you to that. Okay, we have live in here G. Guerreri, Texas A&M. We have Brian Lee of Rice, and we have Diego Bocanegra of U of H. So I'm just going to put it out there to you. How do we make the NWSL more relevant? How do we get more fans into games? How do we get bigger crowds? Because, look, if we're being honest, historically, women's team sports has not drawn at the professional level.
I think you could start with money. The investment, there's just been too much hesitancy in putting money into it to do it the right way. And you know, for a lot of the players who go into the league after being at, you know, at major universities like any of us, you know, it's a step down to the way that they're treated in a lot of the places in the league. And it's only been, you know, recently that things have started to pick up. I know, you know, with James Clarkson coming in here and taking over as the head coach for the Dash, I think it's been a really good thing for the women in that program, because, you know, he's been in the organization for a while, so he has more credibility to what he's asking for. But, you know, I think if you were to ask him, it's like, you know, if we want to be really seen as a professional outfit, then we've got to be a professional outfit. We've got to put a little bit more money into it and not, you know, have our players, you know, traveling around the country in middle seats.
Gents?
For me, that's a big step. But I think it's exposure as well. Why does everyone love the Olympics? One of the things that I think we do in this country very well is we tell the story. We tell the story of the person, not just the soccer player, the basketball player, the track athlete, whatever it may be. And when you start telling stories, then people become interested in the human factor. And I don't think we do that very well on the women's side. I don't think they get the same media exposure. I don't think there's some amazing stories from some of these women and some of the things that they had to go through just to get to where they are. And yes, those same stories are told on the men's side, but I don't think they're told on the women's
side. But to that point, aren't the clubs and the teams also responsible for getting out there and telling the story?
100%.
And creating relationships with local media?
100%. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah, and that's true. Right. And believe me, having interviewed the women and called U.S. Women's National Team games, they're some of the best salespeople going.
Oh, okay, it's unbelievable.
They're tremendous.
I mean, they've pulled the game up by their own bootstraps, is right. What they've done.
Well, and to me, it's a combination of the two. You know, the women's game on TV looks just like the men's game. It's a great replication. If you watch a WNBA, it does not look like an NBA game. But women's soccer, high-level women's soccer on TV, looks very similar to high-level men's soccer. If you can combine that with the right ownership groups, does anyone think Arthur Blank's not killing it if he has a women's team in Atlanta? There's no way. It would be packed crowds. It would be supported in the city and and Arthur would put his means behind it. It's just getting that right combination of marketing, TV coverage, plus the right ownership groups, and it'll blow up. Look, and
why do you think they're hesitant, Brian? That would be my next obvious question.
Well, I don't think it's a slam dunk financially. I think if everyone could go way back 25 years ago, whenever MLS started, you'd have every major investor in the country lining up to say, I want some of that on the men's side.
$3 million to get in the early two to three. Nick the Crafts got in at $3 million.
It's been unbelievable. Three owners, period.
Unbelievable business product. And I think the women's can be the same with this, with the right ownership. You see it in Europe now. What you're seeing at Man City, what you're seeing at Barcelona on the women's side, in Mexico, what you're seeing at Tigres on the women's side.
Yep.
It's just ownership and marketing. If they do it right and if they get after it, it's going to work because the TV product is good. It's like the NFL. NFL is perfect sport for TV. It's not the perfect sport to go watch as a fan. It's perfect for TV, which is where so much of the money and the marketing is generated from. So we just need that right group of owners to take that leap.
And if you take the emotion out of it, if you really just think from a pure business standpoint, if you're an MLS owner or if you have this, every day that your stadium sits empty is lost revenue. You have these facilities built already. You have this. You don't need the same full capacity everything to start. But pure economics, you're cutting your fan base in half if you're only catering to the men. These young girls want to look up to somebody.
Well, and I think they're cutting it in half again when these clubs are putting their name and their jerseys on opponents of the kids who play in the town. So Dynamo are an example of that. You know, you've got Dynamo Dash Youth, which is a big, great organization, but it comes across as that, you know, they're the enemy of my team. You know, my blue team or my red team or my green team. We got to play against the Dynamo Dash. So why am I going to go and support them when they kicked my daughter last week? So I think that, you know, a few of the other markets have done a good job of getting it to where everyone's on board to support. And I think Austin is doing this right now. They're not Lone Star. They are their own entity. And the two big clubs in Austin are both trying to be part of what's going on and saying, hey, we want to be on your team. And yeah, we don't have to be competitors, but we want to help you. And I think you can look at the early success and the passion that's going on just in Travis County and Williamson County.
Yeah, that was the problem with the Dynamo's entry into the youth community in the beginning.
FC Dallas,
too divisive. And there's a lot of suturing that needs to be done and repair work that has to be done. And a lot of times,
because there's a lot of great,
not easy
people
to retract and go back on.
There are so many good in this community. There are so many good people who want to see the game succeed. But if they feel like that's their opponent, then you're kind of cutting your own throat. And I know the economics of youth soccer can be beneficial for some of these people, but you know, can we find a way that everyone's on the same team and working in the same direction?
Yeah, that's I think some clubs have been better at that than others. Honestly,
of course.
Just being at the top of the pyramid, extending the olive branch, making sure they're trying to help everybody and kind of make it a one for all for one attitude. Easier said than done. But like you said, they are doing that in Austin. I don't think there's any question. Anything else on that front?
I want to just add to that is like what you're saying. You look at LAFC, you look at Atlanta United on the boys' side, on the men's side. And from personal knowledge, I know that Atlanta United, exactly what you're saying. They didn't want to take over a club, align with one club. They wanted to align with the community. LAFC did the same thing. I grew up in Southern California. I have a lot of friends that coach club there. And you know, they went to the local clubs and they said, look, here's what we're doing. We want to compensate you, benefit. Yes, some of your players, they're probably going to leave and go to us anyway. So why not align with us? And some of our players that aren't making it here, we're going to send them your way. And it becomes a two-way street and it becomes mutually beneficial. That's what you have to do.
Yeah, nobody's going to lose people to coach and kids to coach.
Exactly.
I mean, just if you want to be a part of the process and – you know, look what happened with the center back, Chris Richards, right? He was here, and Eric Quill finds him in Alabama, brings him to Houston. He's with the Texan Soccer Club, realizes very quickly that this kid's finding it way too easy playing youth soccer. Okay, I got to take him either to the Dynamo or FC Dallas. Sends him to FC Dallas. Now the kids, you know, at Bayern Munich, has been out on loan in the Bundesliga. And, you know, those are the kind of decisions
that should be easy for
a youth coach.
And
it
we can't speak
easy.
For Eric. Eric did a great job when he was here with Texans. But I wonder how much of his decision, again, open-ended, why did he go to FC Dallas instead of going to the Dynamo?
Because the Dynamo. Because he liked the FC Dallas program at the time better than the Dynamo
one. And the Dynamo program is in his backyard and their opponents. And so it just makes it a little bit easier to send him up there. And of course, the FC Dallas program is a great program, don't get me wrong. But it would be nice if we could all get out of each other's way. Yeah. And all go in the same direction, all swim in the same direction.
It's tough, though, when there's so much money at stake. And,
of course.
You know, people's livelihoods are threatened. There's all these other things going on. All right, so here's the one I asked Lisa Baird today of the NWSL. And I always ask this question because I do not have the answer to it. And I think you guys could probably shed some light on this to me. When I look at the NWSL and I look at all the women in this country that started as kids in youth soccer, got dragged all around the country by their parents, playing games, training all week long. Some of them go on to very good college careers. A few of them go on to NWSL careers. And then I look at the women that come to games, and I don't see that crowd that now are wives, are in high-profile jobs. Why aren't they supporting the NWSL? In bigger numbers. I mean, it's almost like soccer was a participatory sport to them, and they didn't like it any deeper rooted. I don't understand that. And so many women I ask that are family people or you know, holding down tremendous jobs, doing tremendous work in the community, whatever. They tell me, oh, I'd rather watch the guys.
Yeah, I think it's a great point that starts with the whole reason for Title IX. So Title IX really started being affected in the early 90s?
79 was when it was enacted. But
well, enacted.
People started following the rules in the 90s.
In the 90s. So it's a generational thing to me, Lo. It's like soccer in the United States as a whole. You know, you got to get generational support before you can really, get the financial backing and have the right people get in the right places. And it's got to become such a generational thing. And it takes literally generations to do that. So the first group of soccer moms were playing participation soccer, for sure. There wasn't even college soccer. Now, the second phase, about as sophomores in high school realized, wait a second, someone will pay me to go to college in the year 2005 that I can get a scholarship and go play. This is great. Free money. I'll go do it. But it was still just a hobby. They just happened to be the right age. Now we're starting to get into the age groups where their mom also had those opportunities, and it became a serious sport. And that's the whole reason behind gender equity in Title IX. But it does take decades and it takes generations. And, you know, bigger picture societal, that they also have to have high-profile jobs and they got to be CEOs of companies and they've got to be partners at the law firms, you know, and things like that where they can really support whether it's college programs or pro soccer and eventually have female owners. It's no different than the minority development. I don't know who the first African-American owner of an NBA team, but it wasn't that long ago, you know. So we're following that same path. So it is going to take time to have that kind of backing behind it, which is just societal.
But what about all your players? Are they players that you guys think one day when they get out into the business world, they become parents, are they going to be people that buy season tickets to go watch the NWSL?
I think yes, and the reason I say that is they grew up watching the NWSL, whether it was forced to because we show them video clips in the locker room and, okay, this is what the best looks like, here's what it is. But, again, they were able to see it, and what Brian's talking about is, okay, this generation that's not buying tickets right now, they never knew that it existed. They never watched it because the NWSL wasn't around when they were coming up through. Now that they're seeing it, it takes time. And I think I see a lot more of those players in this generation. They come back to college games more than they do the NWSL because they have that affiliation. And now, you know, my kids growing up here in Houston, they have that affiliation with the Dash and the Dynamo, and they have players to look up to, and that's those memories that you don't forget. I grew up in L.A. I still remember watching Fernando Valenzuela pitch because I'm a Mexican-American, grew up in L.A., in his prime. I'm a Dodger fan for life for that simple reason. I had somebody to look up to.
Don't say that too loud here.
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
But you get what I'm saying.
By the way, they stole that team from Brooklyn anyway.
Well, and for how long were we America's Next Great Sport as a men's side?
Long time.
You know, we're growing up as kids, and it's in the NASL.
Remember Project 2020?
Oh, yeah, Project 2020. It's awesome. Yeah.
What year is it now? 2021. I guess we didn't win the World Cup. But we're getting close.
Maybe that next generation is going to.
Well, this generation now. We'll talk about that in a minute. But what are your relations? Okay, that's music that tells me we've got to go to break here. We're having so much fun. I don't even know what I'm doing. We're going to take a break here. Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5 out at Hugh O'Connor's Pub, 7620 Katy Freeway. In the house, live and in person, G. Guerrieri, Texas A&M, Brian Lee Rice, Diego Bocanegra, U of H. Give him a round of applause for making the effort to come out here. We appreciate it, guys. Very nice of you to do it. We'll take a break here. Show is always brought to you by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. DaspitLaw.com. We'll take a break more with these three gentlemen next.
ESPN 97.5.
Hi, this is Adam Lundquist from the Houston Dynamo, and thank you for listening to Soccer Matters with Glenn Davis.
All right, a big thank you to Adam Lundquist. He's played for Sweden. By the way, Dynamo Portland tomorrow, Channel 55. You can also catch it on ESPN+. Eddie Robinson, myself, Cindy Bourbano will have the call from BBVA Stadium. Six of the next nine on the road for the Houston Dynamo. I would expect, based on the fact that these teams have played on Saturday, there should be some lineup changes for both the Dynamo and Portland. Portland is welcoming back Sebastian Blanco off an ACL injury. But the Dynamo need this one at home with six of the next nine on the road. That's tough stuff. Need support for Fafa Pico and Maxi Arruti up front. So, you see, that's a big one for the Dynamo and Tom Ramos tomorrow night. By the way, Jan Christensen in the house. Jan, raise your hand, please, here at Hugh O'Connor's. If you are in the market for modern contemporary furniture, he's also a sponsor of the show. Just got back from Copenhagen. Jan, thank you for coming out. We'll have you on the show next week.
He's got his Ericsson jersey on. Yeah, that's good.
He
love
does.
It.
He does. He's one of the greats. All right, so let's get back with G. Guerrieri, Brian Lee, Diego Bocanegra.
Well, you know, you were talking about, you know, what does it take to grow the support of for women to support, you know, the women's game. And, you know, these guys are talking about how it takes time, and it really does. And I think our program in College Station is a pretty good example of it. I mean, we lead the nation in attendance because of the year after year after year and the investment that the local community makes in the game. They see the value. And they know the stories. They know what the players are like. They know what the players come from. And it's a reasonable price,
too. Let me stop you for a second. You do a great job of nurturing that as well.
Well,
you got a university that has backed you, has grown to back you.
Well,
you have educated them as well.
But that's the support.
I guarantee
that's
you've gone into athletic directors' offices and had some.
Yeah, I'm a pain in the neck is the way it works
out. You fought for the game.
But that's what we're saying is at the next level where, you know, a season ticket is not the cost of what it is for a college season ticket in a college town. Just going out and make for the fans, for the locals to feel an ownership in what's going on. I think the Dash are on the right track of getting that done. It's tough that they play in such a big empty stadium. I don't think that helps them that much.
I always thought they should go down to the rugby field.
I agree.
Down there. I think it would be more intimate.
It's not that we want the rugby team to go out of business,
no.
But if someone would just play more games down there, it would be great.
Share the dates. By the way, the Houston Dash will play Orlando on Saturday. And when we're done with this break, we're going to give some tickets away to the Gold Cup. We're going to give some Dash tickets away. We're going to give some Dynamo tickets away as well. So some people are going to walk out of here being able to go to games. So what's your relationship? I mean, I know you guys all know James. I know you've been involved. I know you guys have all been involved with him. But what more can be done to tie in Rice, to tie in A&M, to tie in U of H with the Dash in the NWSL program? Is that a fair question?
I think it is. I mean,
I think it's a great question. I think James is super approachable and has we've got a great relationship with him. And in terms of a partner of Rice University, I can't imagine a headliner of a club doing any more than he does. You know, the collaboration piece, really, they have the players. They got the staff in place. They've got the what the people in the core spots want to do. It's just a marketing piece, and how do we get more people at the games and get collaborative support? And I think she's really onto something with the youth side of things, with the whole Dash Dynamo concept. You're not going to get a 12-year-old from Albion to come out to Dash Dynamo or have their parents buy season tickets because they are competing with them on Saturday,
but
Sunday.
That's the way they elected to go into it now. That's a hard thing to retract and change. Nope. I mean, there's no question that, and then you could go deeper into that. That is a difficult thing to change. Let me ask you guys a question. Could we ever develop something inner city with your three programs and maybe add HBU into it and showcase the college game at BBVA Stadium? You know, I don't know. Try to create an event that showcases the college game a little bit more, because I don't think we do enough. I personally don't do enough on this show with it. I should be. But, you know, there's only so much you can pack into 2 hours. And I'm just thinking there has to be something, if we put our heads together, we could do as far as a tournament, try to get the blessings from the Dynamo. And I think it could be a win-win for everybody. And promoting the college game, you guys have spent your entire lives working at the women's game and being not only coaches but proponents of the sport and the quality of the women's game. Why not?
Yeah, I love the idea. I mean, for me, what I think it is some sort of city league, cup type thing that's within the college season. And the idea you've had with having the Dash support at the end of it, I think, would be fantastic.
Yeah, we've talked about doing this in the past. It's just a matter of scheduling and getting things done. And of course, the pro teams wanting that to happen. I mean, are we a pain in the neck or are we a benefit?
And why would you guys be a pain in the neck?
Well, there's a lot
you're
of moving parts.
But you're growing the women's game like they are. You guys are only assets to me. And it could be players one day coming from your program.
Well, especially with these guys being in town, yeah. I mean, it makes all the sense in the world. And same thing with Houston Baptist. It makes all the sense in the world with them playing games and doing stuff. It's a little bit more difficult for us. I mean,
it's a lot of Aggies in town, G.
I know, and we draw more than
they're
the Dash
everywhere.
Right now.
I'm kind of wishing I went to A&M at some point. I need a good support system.
Well, is there anything more similar than the English league system than college football? If you take a Texas A&M supporter, they don't care what they're playing.
Right. Ping pong.
It could be ping pong, tiddlywinks, whatever it is. If they're winning, they're going to come support it. Same way your little towns all across England and Scotland do for their teams. So if we could develop something along those lines that integrates Texas and A&M, because how many living alumni do you have?
About 600,000.
Yeah. A&M has more graduates a year than Rice has living alumni. So if you throw that all, you know,
that. And the other sports are doing it. I mean, the Astros every year have a Texas A&M night. I
was, yeah, we're
kind of what I'm thinking. You know? I mean, why aren't we tapping into all the alumni of these schools and making it benefit your program and the NWSL and the women's
game? And we have an Aggie that's prevalent on the Dash with Shea Groom. Shea Groom is one of the stars.
And we've got to do more of this. These are things that are sitting right
absolutely.
In front of us.
We've had these conversations, and one of the things we've started to build a relationship, you know, we've had a couple of autograph sessions both ways where our women go to a Dash game and sign autographs before the game, and the other way around where we get a couple of players of the Dash come to our games. We've had talks about playing games there. But if you look at college sports, you know, our football team plays Texas Tech on September 4th at NRG. Because they have a big game every year. Our baseball team, there's a tournament every year that's played at Minute Maid Park. There's no reason that we can't continue to build on that. And with the three of us in here all on board, I guarantee we can get some good teams to come in and play us.
You can draw the rest of the state for sure.
We can play doubleheaders back-to-back, boom, where the three of our teams a tournament weekend, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I see college baseball constantly in Major League Baseball stadiums. I think it's just a big missed opportunity. All right, let's talk a little bit more about what's happening now, because you guys are getting pretty quickly back into it, right? When is your you guys all do camps? You have your camps, which are a major part of your programs. So how quickly are you back into preseason now? Because you just finished the season. Now you got the kind of the pandemic threw us off. But
so it's funny,
August,
it's
right?
funny because I think people think our summers are kind of, you know, casual and wearing flip flops, and it's the busiest time of the year. It's a really crazy. It's a good crazy. A lot better than last year where nothing was going on. But you know, so for us, we've all finished some sort of camp setting so far. Tomorrow is probably a travel day for a lot of college coaches heading out to a big event that Dash Youth Group is playing in. The GAL is playing out in Oceanside, California for about a week. And then next week, we go back across the country to Florida for another eight-day event in the Bradenton area, you know, near Sarasota. And then come back. It's probably some more camps for everybody. And then first, I think it's August 2nd is when preseason kicks off for all of us.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, so it's a quick turnaround. Absolutely.
Especially coming off the season we just had,
right, exactly.
Which usually is 4 months in the fall, and this year was 10 months that didn't end until May.
So you're jamming your camps in, you're jamming your recruiting in.
Hey, we're happy to be out there. We're happy to be out there. It's you know, you'll look at the feast or famine, and last year being the famine of not being able to be out there and not being able to work with kids in the community, not being able to do all those things, and not having, you know, fans really come out and bring the energy to the players. You know, I know all of us are really excited about what this fall looks like it's going to be with full houses and everything else.
Yeah, so when you guys were in the pandemic, you know, we all realized a lot of things about ourselves. Anything that really jumped out to all three of you that might apply a little bit more to coaching or something unique you did during that time period, realizations, whatever?
I'll say this. From what I saw, colleagues around the country and programs around the country, it really stood out, the coaches that really care about their players as people, and the ones that didn't maybe aren't here anymore, retired, resigned, just got out of the sport because the transactional coaches were found out, and the more transformational coaches, and I have no problem saying that because I know the two people next to me and the integrity that comes with them and the people that they are, they care about their players, they care about their programs, and it's more than soccer. And so if I saw anything out of this pandemic, it was that some people that maybe were on the fence, they were forced to, in a good way, to really spend more time treating their players as people and as student athletes, not just commodities, which I saw too often in honesty. And so I think that came to the forefront. I think that was one of the benefits of this.
Yeah, to echo what Diego's saying, I think it became a relationship-based industry and really put to the forefront of how important that is with your players, because our players are all over the place, whether it's all over the country, all over the world, and we still had to maintain those relationships if we wanted to be successful in the spring as well as we went through the pandemic. And then, you know, beyond that, I think in college athletics, we felt a lot like, hey, I got to be 24/7, that included 8 hours a day in the office, you know, and I think we were able to go home and do a better job from off campus, you know, in our own minds. You still have to be on campus when you're on practice. The kids got to be able to see you and those kind of things. But I do think it changed the job to a great degree. We realized, hey, we can do this from different places and still have even a better relationship with our players coming out of it.
Well, the other thing that I think came out of it from an X's and O's standpoint is the fact that everything slowed down. You know, our seasons were diminished last year, and then they were stretched to be the whole season. You know, you never knew what was coming around the next corner. But playing one game a week, we've been playing two games a week for
ever
for more than 40 years, 60 years. And sometimes, you know, in the olden days, it was, you know, Friday-Saturday games or Saturday-Sunday games. So playing double games and just grinding. And now last year it was a situation where, no, you can't do that because of all this testing we have to do in between matches. And the ability for us to really kind of dive in and develop our players. I know for us, you know, so our team that we were playing with as we were making our run through the NCAA tournament was five freshmen and three sophomores in our lineup. And the main reason that was able to be, besides the fact that they were talented players and I've got a great staff, but we got an extra day or two a week to train. And there was a pause at the start of the season, and we got an extra month to train that team. And we didn't have to grind. We didn't have to go two sessions a day. We went one session a day, focused on quality. Soft tissue injuries disappeared because we weren't grinding as much. And the team became closer because it wasn't a survival test as much as it was a developmental exercise. And that was something that we've talked about. You know, is there a way for us to bring some of these good things that happened last year in a bad year? Can we learn some of these lessons and bring them forward? You know, so we've talked about trying to stretch our season out. That going two semesters didn't work. Because
it's not going to work on the women's side?
It's not.
I don't think it can work on the men's side, to be honest. I know they're pushing for that, but you've seen with MLS making their announcement of a new development league and everything. I think they're going to be competing too much with those college players. And to be honest, on the women's side, they didn't want it.
Right. And on the men, well, just in general, around the country, you're in the spring, you're competing with all these other sports that are in season. Right now, we are a big deal in the fall, and that's the way we need to keep it.
Gentlemen, I can't thank you enough for coming out. G. Guerrieri, Texas A&M. G, thank you for making the run down
here.
Brian Lee with Rice University, thank you so much. And Diego Bocanegra with U of H. Guys, a big thank you for coming in here. A big effort from all you guys. And continue the great work you're doing with college student-athletes and these great soccer programs you're running.
Thanks so much. Thanks for what you do for building the game down here in Houston. It's great.
All right, round of applause for our three coaches, G. Guerrieri, Brian Lee, Diego Bocanegra. We'll take a break here. It's all brought to you by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm. Coming up next, Commissioner Don Garber of Major League Soccer.
Is ESPN 97.5. Real fun sports. You're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. Live from Hugh O'Connor's Irish Bar and Restaurant, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, final segment of the night as we welcome you back to Soccer Matters here on ESPN 97.5. This segment brought to you by FM Bar and Kitchen. FM Bar and Kitchen, it's just north of Washington Avenue on Shepherd. Great salads, chicken sandwiches, burgers are great over there. They got the big outdoor patio area. You can bring your dogs, your children, a great mix of people over there, craft cocktails to go along with great food. It's FM Kitchen and Bar, one of my go-tos. Absolutely love the place. You will love it too. They've got monitors everywhere. You can watch all the Euros, the Copa America, the Houston Dynamo, plus a new location at Westheimer and Montrose. It's FM Kitchen and Bar. Earlier today, with a big press conference with new Dynamo majority interest owner Ted Siegel, had a chance to catch up with the Major League Soccer Commissioner Don Garber, 23 years at the top for MLS. Don, thank you very much, as always, for providing some time for me and my listeners. We appreciate it. Let's start with Ted Siegel, the new Houston Dynamo majority interest owner. Let's get some of your early impressions about him. You mentioned in the press conference that you spent a lot of time really getting to learn to know about him and what his ambitions and visions might be for the club.
So, Glenn, I met Ted over a year ago. You know, he has had expressed interest in becoming an owner in professional sports and led a very disciplined process to see what opportunities existed in not just soccer, but, you know, really opportunities in other leagues. And then very quickly he found out that there was an opportunity here in Houston. He's got a soccer passion. He's got kids that play. He's followed the game since he was a young man. So his interest pivoted over to seeing whether he could buy a controlling interest in the Dynamo. And he's a young, smart, passionate, focused, serious guy, has a real plan and a real desire to make his impact here in Houston with the Dynamo and Dash, but also to try to be an influential owner in Major League Soccer and the NWSL. So I'm very excited about that. New blood, man, young guy, a lot of upside.
Yeah, very impressive in the press conference. We're speaking to the commissioner, Don Garber. I've always wondered about the ownership groups and the owners that come to Major League Soccer. Are they courted by the league? Did they come on their own? How does all that happen? Because, you know, these are some of the things that we're not always privy to out in the public. But it is pretty interesting because you wonder, you know, how it all kind of goes down.
Sure, Glenn. I mean, that's what commissioners spend a great deal of their time doing. Leagues are driven by the strength, conviction, commitment, and passion of their owners. They're the ones that are actually leading the clubs in markets across U.S. and Canada. It really depends. It's all very different. In some cases, as in the case of Ted, he was interested in becoming a pro sports team owner, and we heard about his interest and approached him about becoming a lead investor here in Houston. In other cases, you know, there are owners you hear about and then you reach out to them. It really depends. At the end of the day, it's a very complicated process, and particularly here, Gabriel Brenner's owned this team for many years with his partners. He did a good job. He's staying in with all but Jake Silverstein, who was part of his one of his limited partners. So Gabriel will still be around and still be an investor in the team and part of the board, and Ted will hopefully take it to, you know, where it needs to go for the future.
Don, do you find it any way surprising that former players are investing in professional teams at varying levels, obviously, or Gulf States Toyota, Dan Friedkin in Houston goes and spends $753 million for Roma. Does any of this surprise you? I mean, is Don Garber looking at his desk and go, wow, that's kind of surprising, or have you seen it all?
Yeah, I've seen it all, Glenn. I mean, I think there's a new wave of opportunity for folks that have been successful in their day-to-day lives and now have a passion for a sport. In the case here of the local owner for Roma is passionate about the game and saw an opportunity in Serie A. The celebrity athlete thing is new. I'm very intrigued by it, not surprised by it. I mean, these are James Harden as an investor. He's a significant investor in the Houston teams. And he's obviously made a lot of money and has a lot of things he can do with his money. And these are long-term investments, but it's also about building a brand and a sport that could make a difference in the communities. And we're seeing it happen now like wildfire throughout all the leagues. And in MLS, you know, Matthew McConaughey as a investor in Austin and the culture minister and Will Ferrell in Los Angeles and Russell Wilson in Ciara and Kevin Durant as an owner in Philadelphia. This is a relatively new phenomenon, but I think it's actually just beginning.
So some people say Matthew McConaughey, with all due respect to all the players, may have been the best signing that Austin FC had. He's been unbelievable, hasn't he?
Yeah, he has been great.
Yeah, I know you've done a lot with him.
Yeah.
Let me just switch you into, you know, all the different owners. I mean, how difficult is it for you personally? Because they all have differing wants, desires in some cases, right? Is it tough for you to manage that?
I mean,
it's like having a relationship so many people.
This is the work we do, right?
Yeah.
And this is the job we signed up for. As our league has evolved, it's changed dramatically. And we started with three or four founders, and those founders then expanded by one or two teams. And then we went down to Phil Anschutz owning six teams. And then over a five-year period, divesting those teams and now expanding to the point now where we have board meetings that we need to do in a hotel ballroom. We used to be able to sit around a conference room table in a very small office, and it was very informal and easy. So it is different. I mean, it's unique. Most of the commissioners in pro sports have been around a long time, and I think part of that is because of the unique dynamic of both governing a league but also being an employee of ownership. And that there's almost a duality of purpose there, where you're both boss and subordinate at the same time. And that's just something that we do. It's how I'm wired. I've been doing it a long time.
Yeah. Don Garber, Commissioner of Major League Soccer. A couple of quick questions, and we'll let Don go. After the pandemic, obviously you guys did a wonderful job navigating that and getting through that, like a lot of sports leagues around the world. Now what is the priority now? Is this kind of clears and you're looking into the future, or is it simply just getting the league up and running this year, or are there bigger priorities?
It's a good question, Glenn. I mean, first was getting our players back to training and competing, traveling. in a safe environment where we're very mindful of the virus, particularly in the early part, end of last year, the early part of this year. Nobody thought the vaccines would be as effective as they are, which is why we're so focused on getting every player, staff, and everybody in our country vaccinated. Vaccinated America is a safe America. It's the only way we beat the virus. So we were just in the virus, the vaccine hadn't happened as we're planning our 2021 season. We're rolling out a little faster than we thought. We're getting back to full stadiums a little faster, a few months faster than we anticipated. And we got to get back to doing what we do, getting our players on the field, our fans in our stadiums, putting them on our great media partners, and getting the fan experience to deliver, you know, all the excitement that everybody can get connected to. So, yeah, it's getting back to business, but also doing it with a new normal. And the protocols are still in place. A
lot of excitement with Ted Siegel now becoming the more majority interest owner. You can sense it from the fans already. This is a big city, and I know you know this. This is, some people call it the Third Coast. There's 8 million proper in Houston. They're from all over the world. They love the game. They're authentic soccer fans. How important is it for you now, you know, to see this city really become what it should be when it comes to raising the bar here, getting more relevancy, more people in the building, and excitement?
No, I mean, you said it all. I mean, all the reasons you listed is why we want this market to get back to having the relevance, or our team to have the relevance in this market that we need and, frankly, our fans here deserve. 8 million people is a large catchment, it's a large market. It is a very international city. We are the most international league in North America, players from 70 different countries. Our fan base is the most diverse in pro sports. It's the youngest in pro sports. All those things sort of marry perfectly with what this city is and its identity. And all we need to do is to figure out how to get this team to be so connected that it becomes more relevant and more popular and ultimately delivers what we expect it to be able to deliver.
Don, busy day for you. We thank you very much for coming on Soccer Matters ESPN 97.5. Thank you,
Don. Good to see you again.
Big thank you to Commissioner Don Garber, and a big thank you to all of you who tuned in here tonight. You can get the podcast of this show at ESPN975.com. Big thank you to all the guys who came out here tonight. Brian Lee of Rice, G. Guerreri of Texas A&M, and Diego Bocanegra of University of Houston. Hit me up on Twitter, Glenn Davisock, Facebook Soccer Matters. On behalf of your home of the European Championships, Hugh O'Connor's Pub, 7620 Katy Freeway, and also our presenting sponsor, John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm, DaspitLaw.com. I'm Glenn Davis. Good night, everybody. We'll see you back out here next Tuesday. And don't forget, Houston Dynamo against the Portland Timbers tomorrow on Channel 55 and ESPN+.
ESPN 97.5.